Three studies involving more than 7,000 volunteers in Turkey showed corona vaccine to be 91.25% effective. Turkey has reported about 2.34 million infections and around 23,000 deaths. The country has imposed weekend lockdowns and evening curfews to fight the surge in the cases. Turkey is set to carry out the vaccination in four stages, with health workers, elderly, disabled, and adults living in crowded places to take the vaccine in the first stage. Rakhshan Saglam, Istanbul.
In March 2015, Saudi Arabia and some of its allies launched a war on Yemen. The main aim was to throw out the Ansar Allah movement and reinstate former president Abdel Rabu Mansour Hadi, who had fled to Saudi Arabia after resigning. The war that so far had killed tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians has been described by the UN as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. But right from the beginning, it was the United States and its Western allies that supported the war in different forms, either by supplying weapons to Riyadh or undermining the situation in Yemen. With only a few days left for US President Donald Trump in office, he is still trying to do the most harm to the Yemeni people and offer political assistance to his Arab ally, Saudi Arabia. On Monday, the US designated Yemen's Ansar Allah as a terrorist group. Washington said the decision will take effect on January 19th, a day before Trump hands over power to his successor, Joe Biden. The move has drawn criticism from the international community and rights groups. UN officials have also opposed the designation, citing humanitarian impact and dire consequences for the peace process in Yemen.
I am extremely concerned about the impact of the decision from the United States to designate Ansar Allah as a foreign terrorist organization. We fear, in my mission, that there will be inevitably a chilling effect on my efforts to bring the parties together.
During a UN Security Council briefing, World Food Programme Chief David Beasley also slammed the decision and called on the US to reverse it.
We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions.
The US and some other Western countries are major suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia and have been supporting the war on Yemen since day one. Saudi bombardments have already devastated Yemen's infrastructure, turning many schools, hospitals, religious sites into rubble. But the Trump administration never heeded calls by rights groups and politicians inside the US to stop supplying arms to the kingdom. The United States has a history of military adventurism in West Asia. The Saudi-led war is part of a wider American plot to destabilize the region. Will Biden do something to stop the Saudi mayhem or follow the footsteps of his predecessor? That's what the world will be watching in the coming weeks.
The port of Hodeidah, which is the only outlet to the outside world for millions of Yemenis, is still suffering from a forced closure imposed by the Saudi-led coalition. This has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs, increasing the rate of poverty and unemployment in the coastal governorate.
The workers at the port of Hodeidah include 3,500 workers in the port and 500 others in other fields of the port. They support a family, and the closure of the port has eliminated the source of income of these people. The suspension of operations of the port has affected the lives of all Yemenis who depend on the port for the arrival of food and medicine.
This port is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis to receive essential supplies, and its continued closure means they can't easily have access to adequate food and medicine, not to mention the large economic losses for the Yemeni economy, estimated at over $1 billion.
The port of Hodeidah is one of the important ports in the Red Sea, and direct and indirect corporate losses are estimated at $1.24 billion in total. This is a large sum, since the Red Sea Ports Corporation is responsible for 70% of the imports sent to the 20 governorates for more than 20 million Yemenis.
Yemen has been suffering from a sea and air blockade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its war in March 2015, which has destroyed the country's infrastructure, killed tens of thousands of civilians and starved millions of women and children. As the Saudi war on Yemen approaches its seventh year, Yemeni's calls for the demilitarization of Port of Hodeidah continue to be ignored by the United Nations and other relevant international organizations. From Port of Hodeidah, Abdul Latif Al-Washali.
Turkey has the longest continental coastline in the eastern Mediterranean and rejects the maritime boundary claims of Greece and the Greek Cypriot administration in the region. Ankara says these claims are excessive and violate the sovereign rights of both Turkey and Turkish Cypriots. The EU decided on punitive measures against Turkey last year after Ankara asserted its rights in the region by sending several drill ships to explore for energy on its continental shelf. However, the implementation of sanctions has been postponed until March, and Turkey says it is ready to get its relationship with the EU back on track in 2021.
We are inviting Greece, which has been increasing its airspace violations and unlawful activities in islands that are demilitarized, to give up their actions that are raising tensions. I believe that the exploratory talks with our neighbor Greece, which will start on the 25th of January, will, God willing, herald a new period.
European diplomats have signaled the dispute between Turkey and Greece is of paramount importance and also that progress has already been made.
What I have felt from my discussion with the minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu is progress has been made too, both in the way of relations between Turkey and Greece and in relations between Turkey and Cyprus and in relations between Turkey and France, to give you some examples.
Another issue high on the agenda for talks is Turkey's EU membership bid. Negotiations began in 2005, but have since come to a standstill. Erdogan says Turkey's membership will be a good thing for the EU, now Britain has left the bloc.
Uncertainties that are increasing with Brexit can only be dissipated with Turkey receiving its rightful place in the European family. We, as a country, are ready to put our relations back on track and create positive agendas with a long-term perspective.
In recent talks, Turkey has been quick to remind the EU of its dependence on Ankara when it comes to preventing hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants from trying to cross into European nations. Turkey says by taking initiatives in places like Syria and Libya, it is contributing to the EU's security considerably and is calling on the bloc not to allow disputes with individual members like Greece and France to jeopardize that. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In a vote which fell almost totally along party lines, Donald Trump has become the first United States president to be impeached twice. Before Bill Clinton in 1998, there was only one other impeachment ever, reflecting how highly polarized the nation has become. The impeachment appears totally symbolic. A trial in the Senate and a two-thirds vote in favor is needed to actually convict and expel Trump. The Senate will not meet until January 19th, and Joe Biden will be inaugurated as president on January 20th.
Trump will be out of the office in 7 days. I mean, you know, like, I think that I understand and I'm sympathetic to people who want him out earlier, but I just don't think that it's the a priority of anybody who wants to make sure that this doesn't continue. And the goal should be to cut across the sympathies for these right-wing actions.
Just 1 week earlier, the entire world was shocked after a protest burst into the Capitol building, the home of America's parliament, stopping the counting of the Electoral College's disputed presidential votes. Anger, accusations, despair, and emotional outbursts immediately swept the nation and may not lessen even after impeachment. Some top media have compared the events, which occurred on the date 1-6, to 9-11. The Democrat-dominated House of Representatives successfully charged Trump with incitement to insurrection so quickly that many wonder if they have set a dangerous precedent of a so-called snap impeachment. worries are widespread that the only practical result of the historic impeachment is even more division in a nation already racked by the coronavirus, racial strife, police brutality, years of tremendous cultural disunity, and economic catastrophe.
I think that impeachment is a good side dish, but it should not be the focus of anybody who considers themselves to be on the left. I understand why the center might do that, why neoliberals might do it, but Keynesian, you know, if you will, actions such as the $2,000, universal health care, that these things need to be put forth to undermine the growth of the right, the growing right, which I don't think impeachment is going to address.
The controversial decision of the House of Representatives came after the FBI warned that armed anti-inauguration protests are expected across all 50 state capitals starting on January 16th and ending on Inauguration Day at the earliest. The United States will remain in a historic state of tension and animosity until then, and maybe even long after. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Saudi atrocities against Yemeni children are endless. Hodeidah is one of the worst affected areas in Yemen. The children there suffer from life-threatening malnutrition. They are in dire need of assistance and medical treatment.
Hodeidah has a very high malnutrition burden for several reasons. The main reason is the aggression that has besieged the governorate and its coast, preventing fishermen from going to the sea and obtaining adequate food. Another reason is the rising unemployment. Here is the 3-year-old Saba struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit.
The 3-year-old Saba is struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit. The United Nations warned weeks ago that at least 98,000 Yemeni children were suffering from malnutrition at record high rates. However, despite the ongoing collapse of the health system in Yemen, there has yet been no international response.
There has been a noticeable increase in the number of malnutrition cases in the past 2 months. They exceed the hospital's capacity, where we only have 12 beds. We had to receive patients in other departments, such as the emergency department, and this affects the health of children and increases the number of deaths.
The health sector in Yemen has suffered a continuous deterioration amid the Saudi-led war in the country. Saudi-led coalitions of blockade has prevented the arrival of food and medicine to millions of Yemeni children and women. The Saudi-led coalition is not only targeting the Yemeni children with airstrikes, but also violates their most basic rights, such as access to food and medicine, in a clear breach of the international humanitarian law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Al-Hudaydah.
Iran's navy has unveiled the country's largest military vessel called Makran. It is a mobile base that can carry choppers and support the military frigates of the Iranian Army's navy. This 228-meter auxiliary ship was in fact a trade ship, but the army changed it basically to turn into a floating port capable of carrying up to 82,000 tons of warships' needs. The support ship can also carry 5 helicopters and a battalion. It can travel for 1,000 days without having access to ports. Zereh was the other vessel unveiled by the Navy in the presence of top commanders.
The Iranian frigate called Zereh, or Armor, is an extremely useful vessel. It is very fast and powerful and can carry out its missions very well. It is equipped with advanced radars and electronic warfare facilities. Zereh can play a great role in safeguarding Iran's national interests. As the frigate is a totally indigenous one, it shows that our experts have successfully bypassed the sanctions.
Zereh is a missile-launching frigate of 47 meters length that can move at a speed of 35 nautical miles. It can launch cruise missiles up to 300 kilometers. After joining these two vessels, some sudden drills called Marine Power 99 were staged to check the readiness of the forces.
These drills were not on our agenda. The goal was to check the preparedness and quick reaction of our facilities and forces. Vessels, submarines, drones, coast-to-sea missiles were tested during this exercise, and they entered the marked danger zone extending over 600,000 kilometers.
The surface-to-surface cruise missiles, submarine, and flight units of the Iranian Navy took part in the drills.
With these two vessels joining the Iranian Navy, the country's waters are safer than before, and a clear message is sent to Iran's enemies that they should never think of waging a war against the country. Human Abedi, Konarak.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzieh Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Massive military drills of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps have come to an end. This after the IRGC has put on quite a show from central Iran to the Indian Ocean. Mock enemy vessels were targeted with long-range ballistic missiles with precision accuracy, hitting targets up to 1,800 kilometers away. Tehran says the maneuvers sent a message to adversaries to avoid attacking Iran, and military officers reiterate that Iran's might is for defensive means only. Stay with us as we take a look at these maneuvers on this debate.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a two-day massive military exercise in central Iran. During the drills, codenamed the Great Prophet 15, IRGC destroyed Mach enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The first stage of the maneuvers kicked off on Friday by firing surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and operating bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate the enemy's missile shield. On the second day of the drills, the IRGC missiles detected and destroyed the targets as they were sailing 1,800 kilometers away in a remote area in the ocean. The operations were launched in the presence of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, who said Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said the Iranian armed forces will respond with might and promptly in case of any hostile move against the Islamic Republic. The IRGC military exercises started shortly after the Iranian Navy finished its drills in the country's strategic southern waters. The maneuvers are aimed at boosting combat readiness of the Iranian armed forces. The military drills come amid America's stepped-up military threats against Iran in the final days of U.S. President Donald Trump in office. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and imposed heavy sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Trump cited Iran's ballistic missile program, among other issues, as the reason. Tehran's time and again said its missile program is strictly for defensive purposes. Like any other country, the Islamic Republic is entitled to boost its defense capabilities.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Housat, and author and journalist Eric Wahlberg out of Toronto. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off with Brett. Tell us the significance of these latest drills and the timing of them in your perspective.
Well, I think the timing, of course, is of supreme importance here. We're talking about a very dangerous, very volatile time, being the last week now even, of the Donald Trump presidency. We know that Donald Trump is not exactly the most, let's say, held back person, not necessarily the most rational person as well when it comes to international policy in particular. We have seen what he is capable of. We have seen both domestically and in foreign affairs what he can do when he sets his mind to something, and it's not pretty. You know, it's nothing to be proud of. So, of course, for the Islamic Republic of Iran in particular, this is a very dangerous and threatening time. So I think that this is the perfect timing, indeed, to show such an impressive military advancement. We're talking about, according to sources within the Iranian military, that these long-distance ballistic missiles, these missiles that were fired at naval targets, this is a reach that has now been expanded from 300 kilometers in the past to 1,800 kilometers now, which means the Islamic Republic of Iran could fend off a naval aggression over 1,800 kilometers away before they would ever come anywhere near actually reaching the Iranian coast. So this is a very important symbol and a very important signal to make right now, to show that not just the people of the armed forces of Iran are ready to defend their country, but we're also talking about a very modern, high-tech military that has a drone and missile program at the ready in order to defend itself in case of any aggression.
Well, Eric, with what was displayed during the maneuvers and what you've seen, I want to ask you your perspective about the message that it could send and also about the preparedness of Iranian forces.
Well, I agree with Brett. This is a very important step that Iran takes at a very serious, crucial moment when Trump is still threatening and when Biden is coming to power with promises to de-escalate the tensions with Iran and to return to the JCOA peace, so the nuclear agreement. So I think that it's not an aggressive move. It's quite clearly it's a defensive move, and it's important for this to be point to be made before Biden is pushed by his Zionist backers to try and tell Iran to stop supporting Syria, to stop supporting the Houthis, to stop trying to stop the Israeli-U.S. aggression in the Middle East. That Iran's military might is dedicated to self-defense and to defending its allies in the region, and there's nothing subversive about this. It's all above board. It's all according to international law. And so I'm very comfortable to see these demonstrations, and it is encouraging to know that whereas Israel and U.S. are at the forefront of military production of offensive weapons, that Iran is not going to be held hostage to these clear enemies of peace in the Middle East.
Well, actually, Eric, I want to pick up on what you just said. You said you're very comfortable seeing this. Brett, I want to look at that because, of course, we know how Iran is portrayed by many countries, especially Western countries, trying to show that it's basically a very aggressive country. What Eric just said, that he was comfortable because of showing it's the domestic and also defensive capability as opposed to offensive. I want to look at that aspect of it. Why is it that though Iran has not engaged in an offensive war in 200 years in modern history, it is continually labeled and condemned for being an aggressive nation?
Well, this is all, of course, part of the propaganda mill. Indeed, as Eric pointed out, the Zionist backers behind much of the Western governments, of the so-called leaders of the Western world, the Zionists and the imperialist war hawks in general, they have an extensive influence in trying to basically beef up these war drums and beef up this war propaganda. And one of their most commonly used phrases, of course, is projection. Is basically one of the most common tactics of projection, that with which I mean everything that the West does wrong is being projected on another country as if it comes from them. The Western powers will say that these other nations are the ones that are potentially imperialist, expansionist, aggressive, colonialist, or neocolonialist, and are a threat to the nations surrounding them. We have seen similar, very clear examples of this in 2018, when Donald Trump made his demands to Iran. These demands include that Iran has to pull back from Iraq, even though they are there with the permission of the Iraqi government. They have to withdraw from Yemen, even though Iran is not involved in Yemen at all. They have to disengage from Syria, even though the Syrian Arab Republic has specifically asked, of course, for Iranian support in their defense against these terrorist movements that are incidentally backed by the West. So they project these sins and these crimes of the West and try to portray it as if it's Iran that does it, as if it's, for example, also the same thing happens with China, the same thing happens with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Every time when a nation that is not marching to the beat of the Zionists, to the beat of the imperialists in the West, they are portrayed as these madmen that are running around trying to destroy the world. And indeed, when you look at the situation on the ground, you see that Iran is surrounded on all sides by American bases, American forces, American soldiers, vessels, ships, planes, and the entire cabal of the military industrial complex of the United States, and in many ways also the United Kingdom, France, and much of the European Union, and of course the regional allies and puppet states such as Saudi Arabia, and so these. In order to masquerade what is going on here, the democratic West, as they call themselves, are trying to portray this orientalist image of the basically a return to the old medieval and later Nazi propaganda of the hordes from the East, let's say, that are threatening the democratic West, the civilized West, so to say. This is a tale that has been going on for centuries, and in a modern capacity we have seen this return time and again. We've seen this happen during the Korean War, we've seen this happen during the Vietnam War, we have seen this during the war against Iraq, the war against Syria, the war against Libya, and this is something that returns over and over again. So this is a psychological warfare, and unfortunately it has been very, very successful up until recently. Now, fortunately, nowadays we have, of course, the internet and in alternative independent media to combat this monopolization of press and monopolization of the written word that has been dominating the West for so long, but it still remains very, very difficult. And this is, of course, why the Iranian authorities call this the soft war. This is a war of its own, the war of words, the war of truth versus lies, that in many ways is equally important to the actual war of bombs and guns. And this is what is going on here right now, and the war that is being fought in the minds of people every single day.
Okay. Well, Eric, I mean, if we look at, Brett just talked about the war of words. I want to go back to the actual physical war. 40 years ago, of course, when Iran was basically attacked by Saddam Hussein's led Iraq. And of course, Iran tried to get equipment and weapons from everywhere, but basically to no avail, with the help of the U.S. and its allies. We fast forward now, 40 years later, more than 40 years later, and we see the type of technology being used, and a lot of this missile technology, homegrown. I want to look at that aspect and the significance of Iran being able to do this under such severe sanctions.
It's, to me, it's a miracle. I every day I think, wow, Iran is fighting the monster, and it's got enough intellectual capability to do that. And that it really is very impressive. I think that if we can get that message out to people, people will, it's not to make people afraid of Iran, it's to make people respect Iran and its attempt to forge an independent and socially just orientation in the international sphere. And I wanted to commend Brett on his psychoanalysis of the situation, that you looked at someone like Trump, he is really psychologically, he's a very seriously tormented individual. And this projection that you see this every day, that people, they're full of hate and they project that hate onto someone else and say, you are the problem. So I think this is on a world scale, we're having a lesson in the human tragedy and the human comedy.
Well, Eric, let me just jump in here, because you talked about as far as Trump and projection. But is this a Trump problem? I mean, if we look at the history of the Islamic Republic of Iran, almost 42 years old now since the revolution, we've seen from the beginning this type of animosity that Washington has had against Tehran, and whether we're talking about a Democrat like Carter or a Republican with Reagan, or we fast forward all the way to Trump, it really hasn't seemed to have changed between the Democrats and Republicans as far as that animosity towards Iran, and actually basically changing the narrative, as Brett has said, what they have done and their aggression, actually trying to show that it has been Iran. Let me throw this to Brett. Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, this is definitely a key point to make in terms of, you know, American politics. Yes, Donald Trump might be the mad dog of U.S. imperialism in a way, although I highly doubt that Donald Trump is the person who actually came up with things like, you know, assassinating Shahid Qasem Soleimani or the nuclear scientists in Iran who were murdered under his rule. He is more of a person who is the dog let loose, let's say, of U.S. imperialism. Whereas a person like Obama was a person who could show more restraint and could pretend to be more diplomatic. But in the end, their goals are the same. You know, we should not kid ourselves and believe that the United States under Obama was using the JCPOA for a lasting peace. No, for them, they were hoping that through the JCPOA, they could somehow tame Iran into having, like a velvet counter-revolution, you know, like one of those color revolutions that they have been doing in Eastern Europe ever since the late 1980s. You know, they were probably hoping for something like that. Whereas the war hawks of people like, you know, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and what have you, they are more of the, you know, the blood and fire kind of types who want to destroy the nation completely, everyone who is standing in their way, and basically see the destruction all over the place until the United States reigns supreme. But in the end, of course, their goals are similar. Indeed, we have seen aggressive behavior from Democrats like Carter and Bill Clinton and Obama, just as we have seen it from Reagan, Bush, and Trump. This is a cabal, again, to say that word, of a two-headed snake, let's say. These are two sides of the same coin in the United States. Both Democrats and Republicans eventually serve the same interests and have been serving the same interests ever since the country of the United States was founded. This is an issue that has been going on for decades and even centuries. So when you see, you know, Joe Biden take the lead and say, I want to return back to the JCPOA, I want to return back to the negotiation table, we have to be very, very suspicious of their intention, because Joe Biden has said, and that's very important, I believe, he said, we want to negotiate back with Iran, but only, and there it comes, of course, if Iran, quote-unquote, keeps strictly to the rules and regulations and the stipulations of the JCPOA. And the problem is that the Americans have shown time and again that their interpretation of what is written in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is not necessarily what a normal person, you know, a neutral observer, mm-hmm. would believe that it says. They might use this document in order to pressure and push Iran even further.
And what we've seen, Brad, you were talking about using the JCPO, and we've seen actually Trump talk about this, and others have hinted at it. Again, looking now at the missile technology. And Eric, I want to talk about that because in these maneuvers that we just saw, one of it was actually Iran flexing its muscles with that missile technology. And there are those who say that even under a Biden administration, that perhaps they're going to try to go after that. Overall, I just want to look at this situation, and where do you think this is all going at this point in time between the United States and Iran?
Well, I don't really agree exactly with Brett or perhaps with you on the fact that there is a cabal and they're all the same in Washington. I think that that was a brave move that Obama made. I don't know why he made it. I think he was trying to get to put Israel in its place because the Stutz worm that was destroying the Iranian nuclear facilities for a while, that was a U.S.-sponsored secret program that was supposed to be under U.S. control, and Israel took it and ran and did what it wanted. So I think that there is a difference, and I think that Biden is a continuation of Obama. He must be aware of all of that background. He's no fool. And I think that I look at this as the same way as when there was detente with the Soviet Union in the 70s, when the U.S. was weak and it made an agreement with the Soviet Union, and it was very positive. It was very positive for the world. It relaxed the tension. And I really hope, and perhaps I'm being too optimistic, but I hope that Biden will fulfill his pledge to return to the program, allow Iran to get its economy back in shape and to live peacefully in the region with the other people. Iran is not an enemy of Israel. If Israel would just stop being such aggressive and horrible nation, everyone could make peace with it. So I think that Iran plays a vital role here to stand up to the power and speak the truth. And I really hope that that will happen. I'm trying to be optimistic. We've got a few days before Biden comes to power. Let's hope that he does what he should.
Well, Brett, your take. Eric said basically, obviously you heard him, that he's very optimistic. But what it seems, that if we look again at the more than four decades of the existence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is that Washington has a problem with Iran being independent and even morally supporting other independent movements. Your take on the future between these two countries now?
Of course, it's very hard to predict, let's say, or to think about what will happen. But I always try, of course, to be, you know, somewhat optimistic myself in regards of what the future might bring. You don't want to look at it too negatively, of course. But I believe that there is a chance that the United States will eventually learn to, you know, leave Iran alone and let Iran, you know, develop its country the way they want to, and develop ties with whatever country they want to, within the axis of resistance, for example, and beyond. And that America will eventually learn how to cope with it, to deal with it. But I believe the only way in which this is possible is by Iran basically building up its capacities for self-defense and its say, its weight in world politics to such an extent that the United States will be forced to recognize the situation as it is. I believe one of the examples I could use for a nation that has in the past faced incredible hostility from the United States and is now considered by the United States as a normal, respectable partner in everyday politics is Vietnam. Of course, I sincerely hope that Iran does not have to go through the terrible tragedy that Iran had to go through for decades in order to get to that position. But it is a fact that the United States was eventually forced, starting in the, you know, mid and late 1970s, to declare that they were basically, that they had been defeated, that their goals, their plans had been foiled, had failed completely due to the resistance and resilience of the Vietnamese. And ever since then, give or take certain disagreements, the United States and Vietnam are treating each other more or less as equal partners, as just normal nations that conduct diplomacy and trade with one another.
Okay.
So eventually, if Iran really shows itself to be the strong regional power that they are, and that they have every right to be, I believe only that will eventually force the United States to come to the conclusion that they cannot win this policy of maximum pressure anymore.
So resistance and strength is what you said. Thanks so much for being with us, Brett Yonkers, journalist and historian out of Halsat, and Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist out of Toronto. And thank you for being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Glad to have you with us. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Amnesty International, among many organizations, have condemned the Israeli regime's decision to bar Palestinians from receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. The rights groups describe the Zionist regime action as evidence of the institutionalized discrimination that defines the Israeli regime's policy towards Palestinians. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ramzi Barud Ryder, published under the heading COVID-19 Under Apartheid, How Israeli Regime Manipulates Suffering of Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details, please. The Zionist regime's decision to exclude Palestinians from its COVID-19 vaccination campaign may have surprised many. Even by the Israeli regime's poor humanitarian standards, denying Palestinians access to life-saving medication seems extremely callous. Amnesty International, among many organizations, condemned the Israeli regime's decision to bar Palestinians from receiving the vaccine. The rights groups described the Zionist regime action as evidence of the institutionalized discrimination that defines the Israeli regime's policy towards Palestinians. According to the Palestinian news agency Wafa, 1,629 Palestinians died and a total of 160,043 were infected with the deadly COVID-19 disease as of January 4th. While such dismal numbers can also be found in many parts of the world, the Palestinian coronavirus crisis is compounded by the fact that Palestinians live under the Zionist regime military occupation, a state of apartheid, and, as in the case of Gaza, an unrelenting siege. Worse still, starting early last year, the Zionist regime military conducted several operations in various parts of the occupied territories to crack down on Palestinian initiatives to provide free COVID-19 testing. According to the Palestinian rights group Al-Haq, as early as March 2020, several field clinics were shut down and medical equipment confiscated in the Palestinian town of Gharbat Ebzik in the Jordan Valley, in the occupied West Bank. This pattern was repeated in East Al-Quds, Al-Khalil, and elsewhere in the following month. There is no legal or moral justification for the Zionist regime's action. The Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949 asserts that an occupying power has the duty of ensuring and maintaining the medical and hospital establishments and services, with particular reference on taking the preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. International and Palestinian human rights groups have long reported on many unnecessary deaths among Palestinians in Gaza because the Zionist regime deliberately prevents Gazan hospitals from acquiring cancer medications. Long before the onset of the coronavirus, the Israeli regime has weaponized medicine, and Gaza's dilapidated health sector is a standing testimony to this injustice. Perhaps the overcrowded Israeli prisons remain the glaring testimony of the Zionist regime's mishandling of the COVID-19 outbreak, despite the repeated calls by the United Nations and particularly the World Health Organization that states should take immediate measures to help ease the crisis in their prison systems. The Zionist regime has done little for Palestinian prisoners. Al-Haq reported that the Israeli regime has taken no adequate measures to improve provision of health care and hygiene for Palestinian prisoners in line with the WHO guidance for preventing COVID-19 outbreak in prisons. The consequences were dire, as the spread of COVID among Palestinian prisoners continues to claim new victims at a much higher ratio compared with Israeli prisoners. The Israeli regime's intentional hampering of Palestinian efforts to fight COVID is consistent with a trajectory of racism, where colonized Palestinians are exploited for their land, water, and cheap labor, while never factoring as a priority on the Israeli regime's checklist, even during the time of a deadly pandemic. The Zionist regime is an occupying power that refuses to acknowledge or respect any of its basic obligations as an occupying power under international law. The Israeli regime attempt at manipulating Palestinian suffering as a result of the pandemic should also challenge our view of the fundamental relationship between the Israeli regime and the Palestinians. Frequently, we speak of the Israeli regime's apartheid in Palestine, often illustrating that assertion, referring to giant walls, fences, and military checkpoints that cage in Palestinian communities and segregate them from another one. This, however, is merely the physical manifestation of the Zionist regime colonization and apartheid. In the occupied, apartheid runs much deeper as it reaches almost every facet of society where Israeli Jews, including settlers, are treated as superior, while Palestinian Arabs, whether Christian or Muslims, are denied their most basic rights, including those guaranteed under international law. While the Zionist regime's behavior is not entirely surprising, it being consistent with the sordid reality of military occupation and institutional racism, it is also self-defeating. Despite the obvious imbalance in the relationship between the Zionist regime and the Palestinians, they are in constant contact, not as equals, but as occupier and occupied. Since the coronavirus does not respect the Israeli regime's matrix of control in Palestine, it will travel across all of the physical divides that Tel Aviv has created to ensure permanent oppression of Palestinians. Hence, there can be no containing of COVID-19. in occupied Palestine if it continues to spread among Palestinians. Long after the deadly pandemic is contained, the tragedy of occupied Palestine will sadly continue unhindered until the day that the Israeli regime is forced to end its military occupation of Palestine and the Palestinians.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.